I've checked in with our presenters, who do sound like they are ready to go. So I'm going to go ahead and officially welcome everyone to today's CLUIN seminar. Again, my name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be helping to moderate our seminar today. The NIEHS Superfund Research Program has sponsored our webinar, which will run from 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern. And our session today will look at the Superfund Research Program and its funding opportunities. We'll be joined by a number of presenters from the Superfund Research Program, and their information is displayed on the screen, or the main slide, slide number one. Before we start, though, with the technical portion of our broadcast today, I'm going to cover a couple of housekeeping items and reminders, and then turn things over to our speakers. So I'm going to move along to our next slide, which is our housekeeping slide. Our entire session today will be broadcast online through Adobe Connect. So our participants will actually be able to sit back and listen and watch in real time through an online meeting tool called Adobe Connect as our presenters advance through the materials. You'll also find that there are a series of interactive windows available to you that will allow you to browse through a number of websites and submit comments and questions to our presenters. We do have materials available to download in advance from the seminar homepage. That's the same page you would have seen when you signed up for the seminar today. However, if you are only listening on the phone and have simply downloaded a copy of the presentation, there may be some elements that you won't be able to fully follow along with. So I would encourage you, if you can, to try to join the online broadcast in Adobe Connect. So again, if you signed up for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage. On that page, there was a description of the session, slides to download, contact information for all the presenters, including myself, and most importantly, a button to the left side of the screen that says Go to Seminar. If you click that, that'll actually allow you to check in and join the online broadcast. Audio will be streamed online by default for all participants, so you'll be able to actually listen to me through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems with the online audio, I'd encourage you to first take a look at the volume controls. You'll probably see at the top of your screen in Adobe Connect a speaker icon that's hopefully shaded green. If you try clicking on that, that'll allow you to try to adjust the volume online. I'd also encourage you to take a look locally at your own speakers or sound control on your computer or mobile device. You may need to adjust or boost those in order to hear things. Sometimes simply wearing a pair of headphones can help. All of the telephone lines have been globally muted. If you have any problems with the online audio, we can give you information to join us on the telephone lines. Simply type a message into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, and I'll be happy to share that call-in information. But again, we will keep you on global mute until we get to a point for Q&A with our presenters if you're joining us on the phones. Remember, you will use that Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message from me in there. Each individual participant can type a message at the very bottom of the Q&A window, press enter, or simply click the little cartoon bubble that appears to the right to privately submit your comment or question. When we take a break for Q&A, I will read out the questions to the presenters so they can actually address them out loud. The questions, again, are privately submitted. No one other than myself and the organizers will see the questions. You can also use that same space to report technical problems, simply make comments, or interact with us in any way throughout today's session. We are recording our seminar today, and you will get an automatic email as soon as that recording link is available for free downloaded replay. If you like what you're seeing today, we do internet seminars like this all the time on the Cleanup Information Network, and we have nearly 500 different sessions which are currently available for free replay through our archives. Just one quick little reminder, this is a general screenshot of the interface you should be working with. So you should see the slides appear and sort of move in real time through the main portion of your screen. Each individual participant can try to control their online audio broadcast using that little speaker icon. Another thing you might want to take advantage of is a full screen button. Each participant can actually expand the slides and blow them up to a larger size on their own end if they need to. If you want to turn the full screen view off, simply press the full screen button again, and that'll downsize the slides and collapse them back to their normal size. You'll see our Sponsored By logo for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Their Superfund Research Program appears here in the upper right corner. Below that, you'll see a collection of related URLs. Each individual participant can click on those websites, press the Browse To button, and open them up locally. That complete list of related URLs is available on the seminar homepage. So if you want to access them later on or want to copy them all at once, again, you can simply go to the seminar homepage. There's a top URL there, and you'll see a button for links. And that's got the whole collection of websites that we've bookmarked here as well. but I'll point everybody to that before we close things out today. And then lastly, that all-important Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner. You can type your private comments and questions here and press the cartoon bubble to submit them. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to turn things over again to Danielle and Michelle to begin the technical portion of today's broadcast.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Superfund Research Program Funding Opportunity Web Seminar. I'm Bill Sook. I'm director of the Superfund Research Program at NIEHS, and I want to thank you all for participating in this webinar. We see this as an opportunity to reach out to potential grantees, answer questions about the program, and provide contact information for further questions. We're really pleased that there is so much interest in our program. There are almost 100 registrants today. From a quick survey of the list of participants, it appears that we have individuals who might be new to the SRP and its funding mechanisms, as well as a number of veteran applicants who are probably well-versed in the program. For this reason, we've designed the presentation to provide a little something for everyone. We've highlighted the nuts and bolts about the funding opportunities, but also provided helpful hints to share a little about the nuances and subtleties of putting together a really competitive application. But the key to putting together a competitive application is to contact us early on in the process and to keep that communication open as you put together your application. This is not an easy thing to do, these applications. Take advantage of this opportunity to work with us. And this is a nice segue to introducing the NIEHS staff who are here. We have a whole room full of people here in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. So I'm going to now go around the table, or they're going to go around the table and introduce themselves briefly. We're going to go in this direction.
Okay. Hello, everyone. This is Heather Henry, Superfund Program Administrator.
Hi, this is Danielle Carlin, also a Program Administrator.
Hi, my name is Linda Bass, and I am a Scientific Review Administrator.
Lisa Edwards, Grants Management Specialist.
Michelle Heacock, Program Analyst.
Hello, everyone. This is Michelle Victolino, Grants Management Specialist.
Great. Thank you very much. The next slide gives us the agenda for today. So you've had the webinar instructions. You're going to have an introduction, which is taking place now. Then there'll be a multi-centers funding opportunity. You can see it there. There'll be question and answers. So our plan today is to provide a brief overview of the SRP itself, our recent strategic plan, and then to describe current research center funding opportunities, both in terms of the science, but also the application and review processes. We will also provide some information about the new electronic submission process. We'll then have some time for live questions at the end. Slide 3 are the mandates of the Superfund Research Program. I'm not about to read all of these. You should have them memorized by this time. You'll be tested on this later. Let me start with our program mandates, okay? These are part of SARA, Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, that were established in 1986, which established our program. The mandates outline basically 4 areas of research: human health effects, risk assessment, detection, and remediation, all to address issues of surrounding hazardous substances. All of the funding mechanisms we talk about today are consistent with these mandates. From these mandates, our funding mechanisms are derived. Per our program mandates, research grants must be submitted through accredited U.S. universities. However, applicants are encouraged to collaborate with others in governments, nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations, and other academic institutions, including foreign institutions. Next slide, please. In addition to our mandates, our program is guided by our strategic plan completed in 2010 through an extensive and open drafting process. By the way, everything that I'm talking to you about is found on our website, including our strategic plan. The final plan stresses our continued dedication to program relevance and identifies our key stakeholders as Superfund programs at the US EPA and ATSDR, as well as other entities responsible for sites impacted by hazardous substances and the communities living near these sites. We also highlight the importance of program research to achieve impact and promote innovation. So, during today's presentation, I encourage you to consider how to design meritorious scientific studies that are relevant to key stakeholders that will make an impact to Superfund and will bring innovation to the practice of managing and reducing the burden of hazardous substances. Now, I am going to turn this over to Heather Henry, who will introduce the P42 grant opportunity. Heather?
Thank you, Dr. Sook. So I'm going to be talking about the multi-project centers, or the P42. This is a unique NIH mechanism assigned to the Superfund Hazardous Substances Research and Training Program. So that's us. And the goal of the P42 centers ultimately is to improve public health through integrative research, providing sound science to inform the ongoing risk assessment and remediation management activities that occur at the numerous hazardous waste sites across the country. So our hope is to really bring the expertise of not only the health, but also the environmental science research community to address some of the intractable issues that are being faced by the Superfund program. So SRP does also have other grant mechanisms. The small business program is one. We also have occasional requests for applications. Right now we have one out on the street for an R25. And R13s for conference mechanisms. We won't be talking about those other mechanisms today, but we do encourage you, if you ever have questions about that, to contact us, because we're happy to let you know about that. But today we're focusing on the P42 call for applications, because it is quite a complex type of mechanism. So just to give you a depiction of what a P42 center is conceptually, we have this slide here showing, again, that the center is developed around mechanistic research to solve a particular problem or a set of problems related to the health effects, risk, detection, and remediation of hazardous substances. And we want people to be using biomedical research, environmental science, research translation, and community engagement in order to really identify key critical problems and find the right mechanistic research to address and solve those problems. So starting with the center of this slide, we expect applicants to focus on a problem and to interact with stakeholders or impacted communities to identify key issues that are in need of mechanistic research. So in our recent RFAs and in response to our strategic plan, we ask that applicants craft their scientific inquiry so as to result in data or information that leads our stakeholder groups towards solutions that improve health outcomes, reduce the risk or uncertainty of exposure, or improve site assessment and remediation practices. So I'm going to talk about the scope of the P42 research centers. The scope, as you can imagine, derives from our broad mandates, and I've listed them again on the right in the orange box. So in addition to our mandates, our program is guided by the strategic plan, which was completed in 2010, which, as Dr. Sook mentioned, stresses our continued dedication to program relevance, identifies our key stakeholders as the Superfund program sisters or sister programs at the US EPA and ATSDR, as well as other entities that are responsible for sites impacted by hazardous substances and the communities living near or impacted by these sites. Again, we also mention in the strategic plan our interest in transdisciplinary research and forward-looking research. So while application is very important, it's also important that we're driving new science, scientific directions, and forging the way ahead with paradigm-shifting research. So again, innovation is also very important in addition to the impact and the relevance of your science. So when you fashion the scope of your proposal, the column on the left, we hope, will be helpful to help you keep in mind. The scope is broad, but there should be a link to the Superfund research program, that is, our mandates in the strategic plan. So we've provided an RFA webpage document on this slide, and on that webpage, there's a list of suggested research and activities, which will give you a good idea of the type of research that we're looking for. We poll our EPA and ATSDR colleagues to find out what kind of mechanistic research they need, and so we pulled together a very comprehensive list. So we ask that you definitely have a look at that webpage for specific ideas of research topics. We also encourage you to look at our current grantees, our list of people who are currently funding, because we want you not only to get a sense of the type of research we fund, but also to be cognizant and aware such that you're not proposing research that we already fund a lot of. In fact, you want to look for ways to complement the existing research within the center. And lastly, we do want to emphasize that work on Superfund sites is definitely not required. We are not a site-specific program. We do this on purpose because we want the results from this Superfund research program in general to be generalizable to many sites or many scenarios where there may be exposures to hazardous substances. So again, it's great if you're working with or if you're getting your inspiration from interactions at a hazardous waste site, but it is certainly not a requirement. So the next slide, we wanted to talk about the nuts and bolts. Again, so the program components that are used to cover the broad mandates that we have through the SARA legislation. And we do this through requirement of interactive projects and cores that have a variety of health and environmental disciplines, as well as training, community engagement, and research translation. So all of these are to be tied together and integrated to address a problem or set of problems that are encountered by exposures to hazardous substances in the environment. So to the left in green and lavender, we represent the research projects. So to the right are the cores. And current RFA requires a minimum of two biomedical and two environmental science projects, as well as a required administrative core, a research translation core, community engagement core, and training core. We have budgetary limits that are listed below, and in addition, we do have a component list or limitation so that you're required to stay within 12 components. So that's the total number of projects and cores need to equal or be less than 12. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the research projects. It's important to note that each project is standalone, independent testable hypotheses, and if your project happens to be a little more application-based, like engineering, it's important that your project has a logical progression of tasks. Preliminary data is also very important. We need to be assured that the research that you're proposing has justification and can be done, and that you're going to have a high likelihood of success. So previous research that you're building on, previous data is very important for your research projects to do well in review. While each project is standalone, there's certainly a requirement for a degree of interconnectivity between the projects. And at a minimum, the center should be seeking a solution for some central problem so that each of the projects should, just by nature of the problem that they're addressing, should relate to one another, at least topically. But what we're really looking for are center applications where the central problem really involves the natural interaction between the biomedical and environmental science disciplines. I mean, that's how it is out in the real world. When you're dealing with the management and risk assessment of hazardous waste sites, it's not just biomedical research, but it's also an integration with the environment and how humans come into contact with substances in the environment. So we really want projects to attack a different angle of the problem, drawing from the expertise in the biomedical and the environmental science research. In terms of interaction, we've listed a few ways in which that's manifest in the application. That might be through shared research aims, sharing of data and specimens and technologies. I also want to mention how important the cores are, the required cores, to be integrators of the center. Interactions with research translation are very important. We'll touch on that a little bit later. But I do want to point out that the interactions with training and community engagement and research translation can be really important integrators for your program. So next, just want to talk a little bit more, give you some helpful hints for your projects. Centers, in general, when you pull together all of the projects, biomedical and non-biomedical, really you want to make sure that this is as lean as possible, both in terms of the total budget that you're requesting, but also the total number of research projects. Especially for new centers, you want to stay focused and not try to do too much. So you should be very judicious in the type of projects that you're including. And, you know, again, keep it lean, keep it focused. We also remind applicants to have a really good editor with fresh eyes to make sure that all the interactions between the projects and cores are cross-referenced throughout your entire application. Just as a reminder, different reviewers are going to be reviewing different projects and cores, and so it's very important that you have that consistency throughout your entire application. It's also worth noting that P42 reviewers, you know, we might have 60 to, you know, 80 people in the room and on a conference call for this review. So just important for you to know that they have very broad expertise across all of the people that are in the room. So a project investigators, it really behooves them to consider writing your abstract and titles in a language that is understandable for a skilled audience who, yes, may have an advanced degree for certain, you know, they're participating on an important review panel. However, they may not have your specific expertise in the field. So just another strategy for you. This is in keeping with the NIH policy, but it may be really important for the P42 because of the interactions between projects and cores. Reviewers really are going to be looking not only at the project that they've been assigned to, but other projects and cores within the application. So I just want to talk real quickly about resource sharing plans because this is a relatively new concept. This is outlined in the RFA, and we have suggestions for investigator-initiated research translation plans within our suggested research and activities. And what this is we're just really calling out to the project leaders for each project to find and make plans to stimulate the utilization of your research. So really come up with a plan of attack for how at a later time, just for the interest of time. So I will go into a little bit more detail about each of the cores. The administrative core is a required element, and it's essentially the executive branch of the program. It will provide structure to the multi-project grants and is responsible for ensuring integration between the projects and cores, effective translation of the outcomes of the program, and oversight through the establishment of an external advisory board. So the RFA details the requirements of the admin core, which is highlighted on the left. So if you focus on the boxes to the right, a well-thought-out admin core breaks the silos between disciplines, breaks the silos between basic and more applied research, and really creates an environment that encourages translation. So although it is not a requirement, it's really good. Reviewers like it when they see that admin cores are looking out for the mentoring of junior staff and trainees. I mean, this is all about, you know, bringing up and strengthening the future of environmental health science research in the future. And so the mentoring is very important. And again, along the same lines, if perhaps your center leadership may be impacted by retirements of senior staff, it's also good in your admin core to consider including transition plans. Next, I want to talk about the Research Translation Core, or RTC as we sometimes call it. The purpose of our RTCs is to communicate and facilitate the use of research findings coming from the center in the manner most appropriate for their application and advancement of research objectives. So our Research Translation Cores have four components, and all centers are required to have a plan for carrying out each of them. So those requirements are communicating within the SRP, partnering with government agencies, technology transfer, and information dissemination to other end users. Just a few points to make. SRP's translation is not NIH's version. It's not clinical-based. Rather, we want you to think more broadly. moving the information from the center to outwardly to end users. And having a plan to keep SRP appraised of your events is also a responsibility of the core. So it's important that you establish a contact person in your application for carrying on those activities. And again, our suggested research and activities document gives some ideas about what to be doing under these four RTC components. And speaking of those components, I did want to talk a little bit more specifically about three of those components, the first of which being within communicating within the SRP. So this is, again, this is a rather new concept for our RFAs, but we're really asking the research translation cores to be responsible for ensuring that all of the projects have a plan to pursue their research translation activities. So again, these investigator-initiated research translation activity descriptions should be done in coordination with your research translation core. So in other words, the members of the core should have the expertise needed to communicate effectively, whether they're working with the biomedical or the environmental science project leaders. RTC should also coordinate with investigators of each project to determine their plan for investigator-initiated research translation. These plans should be cross-referenced in both the core description of the research translation core as well as in the project's investigator-initiated research translation paragraph. And again, that was part of the data sharing plan that we talked about previously. So regarding the partnerships with government agencies, just to mention, we do prioritize EPA and ATSDR based on our program mandates, but we just want to make sure that it's clear that this is not a requirement. For some of you, it might be a lot more practical and effective to be working on non-EPA, non-ATSDR sites and activities, and that's absolutely fine. We do want to keep your activities coordinated with the EPA and ATSDR, but again, it is not a requirement. If you are working on a Superfund site, that Superfund site will have an EPA remedial project manager. So at the very least, it really makes sense to have made contact with that specific person. That's an important interaction that's going to ensure the success of your activities at that Superfund site. We have other tips, again, on our research and suggested research and activities document. So lastly, I just want to talk about the information dissemination to other end users. Again, this is a recent update in our RFAs, and it's going to include a lot of the activities that might have been considered outreach. And by outreach, I actually mean like what has kind of typically been called community outreach. So in other words, education materials, interacting with high schools, that used to be considered, and it still is considered, community outreach activities. Well, that's kind of what we mean for this information dissemination to other end users. So we also encourage you to work with professionals, waste practitioners, lay public, and other academic researchers. So there's a lot that you can be doing under the information dissemination to other end users. And next, we're going to talk about the Community Engagement Core. This is required. They serve the program and center by supporting or guiding communities, community advocates, or community organizations drawing from the science of the program. So this is a required core, and it's very important to establish the bidirectionality of the connections between the community as well as the center investigators or the community engagement core. So the RFA has a rather broad definition of target communities, and I've listed that here. Again, we want to highlight the bidirectionality. The application includes a section on community engagement component statement. That's something that you would be including with your application that gives you an opportunity to really highlight how you're going to achieve bidirectional interaction between the center and the community that you're working with. You know, it's a good idea if you are working with a community group to get a letter from them that just gives us an indication that you have been working. Gives us an indication that they're aware of the nature of the interaction between their organization, their community, and yourselves, the applicant. And like the RTCs, we recommend visiting our additional resources webpage. We have a lot of information for community engagement, how to get started, et cetera. And Okay, and this is just a frequently asked question. A lot of times there's a little confusion between research translation and community engagement. And certainly these two cores do have a shared challenge, and that's finding the most appropriate end user or community group, as the case is, for this center research and its activities. But there are some differences between them. RTC should be information and products from the center to other centers, as well as from the center and outward to all end users, all types of end users. Community engagement core is bidirectional, and it involves interaction specifically with community groups. So at its best, a research translation core helps establish an iterative exchange between the stakeholders that the investigators have identified. The end user can be a valuable resource in aiding researchers as to how to tweak their research in a way that maximizes its eventual use in the real world. So we really do encourage investigators in coordination with the research translation cores to be establishing these interactions with potential stakeholders and end users early on as the project is written up, as the project continues and goes on. And of course, it's very, very important when you've interacted with these people along the way to present to them your final discoveries as a conclusion of your research completes. So I'm going to move on to the training cores. The training core promotes graduate-level cross-disciplinary training. We highly value this component as the cross-training of graduate students is a really, really excellent way to achieve linkages and integration between projects and cores. So reviewers, they're really interested in knowing how you're going to recruit students and postdocs into the training core. How successful have your trainees been in the past? That's another thing they want to know. Want to point out that there is a cost restriction to the training core, as is the case for the previous two cores that I mentioned, or three cores that I mentioned before, the community engagement core, the research translation core, and the admin cores. So we want encourage you to look at those. And we just want to let you know that the budget for the training cores can include core leader and staff. They can include expenses associated with the core, and it can also include support for the trainee themselves. Danielle Carlin is in the room, and she is leading our training core activities, and will be here to answer any questions you have about that either today or at a later date. And research support cores, these are optional. The research support core supports a particular research function shared between at least two projects. That might be analytical work or data analysis, or could be more technology-driven. But we, in the consideration of the cap on the project, which again is limited to 12, we decided to allow centers the option of whether to include research support cores, knowing that many universities have facilities already available for people to use. So these cores, again, I want to stress, are an excellent way to stimulate interaction between the projects, and they're a great way to integrate the entire program. So it can really be an asset to your center. Encourage you to include them if it's appropriate. Also, just to note, in your application, research support core does require QA/QC documentation, which we describe in the RFA. And then we also let you know that if you do not include a research support core, we would just encourage you within your projects to adequately detail the research support or the activities that are analytical in nature, data analysis. You really need to establish that you have the quality control within the project if you're not going to be looking into having a research support core. So now I'm going to talk about just recent changes. We are, again, limited to 12 components of projects and cores. In recent years, training cores have become required, and in recent years, the research support cores have become optional. Again, there's more instruction given on the research sharing plan for projects, but that, again, is a relatively new thing. And in addition, we really ask you to look at at review criteria. There have been changes overall to the significance, investigator, innovation, approach, and environment, not only for the overall center and projects, but also for the cores themselves. So really do pay attention to the RFA and the section that details the review criteria. So there have been cost limitations for CORS and for the overall center as well. Those are listed here. If you have any questions about that, I'll be more than happy to talk to you. Maybe offline is better, just in the interest of time. And then just one more slide about recent changes. Again, research translation plan for each project should be included within the research translation core, and this should have some linkage to the investigator-initiated research translation plan, which is a part of the project description. Research strategy, because of the changes in the application, that has been reduced. So if you applied 5 years ago, your application needs to be a lot shorter this time. Also, there's a new review scoring system that has happened in the last few years. Only one resubmission is allowed. And again, the Community Engagement Core is a more recent addition. But things that have not changed is the fact that, our centers are not a site-specific program. Basic to application-oriented research is fine, so we're going to find that some of the projects are very basic, and some, are looking at mechanisms, but mechanisms that really have an application for something that is perhaps a lot more tangible. So we're going to have a wide variety of research that's acceptable for our centers. And again, another unchanged characteristic is just how much we value innovative approaches to research. So lastly, we just want to highlight aspects that we think make a successful P42 center. This is when it comes to the review. As a helpful tip, projects and cores really do need to be uniformly meritorious, so focusing, again, on making a good case for how your project is going to be successful, how your core is going to achieve its goals, very important. Integration, interaction, and synergy remains very important between the biomedical and our environmental science projects and cores. We want you to be addressing an important problem that needs to be very clear throughout your entire application. And we want to see you making the connection between that important problem and how you can aid stakeholders in effective decision making. So with that, I will hand it over to Linda Bass. I'm sorry?
Are you going to my slide?
Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Again, I am Linda Bass in the Scientific Review Branch and will be conducting the review of applications that submitted in April. What I'd like to do is just to give you an overview of what will happen to your application once it's submitted to the NIH. First of all, we do expect letters of intent in March, and although they are not required, it's important to give those to us, because it gives us an early idea of the expertise that will be required for the peer review. You are welcome to email those letters to me. You do not have to mail them to me. About a month later, you will submit your application electronically. Application first will go through CSR. And what CSR will do is they will look for the through the applications for compliance, for general compliance to the page limitations and to the font limitations. Once they get in CSR, they will put them in our impact system, and we will be able to pick them up here at the NIEHS. Now, once our review office have a chance to look at your application, we, again, will look at your application for compliance, and this is more responsiveness to the review as far as having all the required components, adhering to the page limitations, and seeing if there's any general missing information. Once SRB, our Scientific Review Office, gets through the application, we will have a meeting with program and grants management staff to again look at the applications for responsiveness to the RFA. Now, the outcome of that particular administrative review will result into either two things: applications being deemed non-responsive, and if that's the case, they are returned to the applicant without review, or applications being deemed responsive. And those applications deemed responsive will go through full peer review. A review committee is convened based on expertise, scientific and non-scientific expertise required to review the applications. And the application and supporting review information is sent to the review committee. We like to do it within 4 to 6 weeks, but we try to do it for large programs about 8 weeks to give the review committee an opportunity to thoroughly look through the applications to which they were specifically assigned, as well as any other application to which they do not have conflict. Since applications are coming in April, the peer review will generally take place sometime in the fall. And this is another opportunity where there's two decisions to make. Applications will be streamlined. Those that are deemed not discussed will not go through further peer review, but will get a summary statement of the reviewer comments. And then you have the other category where they will be discussed, assign a priority score, and will receive a summary statement. And then they go to council in February. In regards to the letter of intent, again, the letter of intent is used to help us plan the review meeting. It's particularly in regards to the required expertise. It's always helpful to get a heads up on the type of expertise that would be needed, especially for large review meetings. If possible, what we like to see in the letter of intent is a description of the research in the center, as well as a list of the research projects and the research cores, and also if you will identify the project and core leaders, that would be a big help. In addition to that, we also like to have an indication of the institutes that would be participating in that particular application. Again, letters of intent are not required, but we do recommend those. And like I said before, you are welcome to email those to me. So once the application goes to the review committee, what we will do, we will review all the research projects in this order, research projects, the cores, and then we will review the overall center. And we have listed here the review criteria that's included in the RFA. I do recommend that you look at those review criteria and keep those in mind when you are writing your application. In regards to research projects, now, the way we review these are based on the NIH R01 type of application. There are 5 specific review criteria: significance, investigators, innovation, approach, and environment. And each one of those will get a criterion score. In addition to that assessment, the review committee will also consider the contribution of the project to the center and overall, as well as any other specific criteria that's in the RFA. An important note to make is that if there are any concerns with human subjects, animals, or biohazards, those are factored into the overall impact score. Now, each research project, both the biomedical and non-biomedical, will get an impact score. In addition to that, each of the cores that's listed in your application will be reviewed separately, based on the criteria for that particular core, and also included in the evaluation will be the contribution of that core to the center itself. Again, each core will have an impact score, and each of the criteria that's set forth in RFA will be involved in the evaluation of each one of those cores. The last thing we're going to do is to look at the overall center. As a reminder, when the committee is charged with evaluating the overall center, they are instructed not to average the scores of the different components. That is not the intent of the overall center, nor of the evaluation criteria for averaging the scores. The overall center is more than the average of the individual scores. For your overall center, it's important that you make sure you clearly address that there is a critical problem relevant to the Superfund program. In addition to that, you need to make a case that the relevance of the individual and the merit of the individual projects and cores, that the scientific benefit of combining those is demonstrated in the overall center. In addition to that, it's also important that the center demonstrates that it has a multidisciplinary, that it is a multidisciplinary cohesive unit, and that the sum of the whole is greater than those individual components. That is probably the number one issue when rating overall center. You may have outstanding projects and cores, but if they don't cling together, if there's no signs of collaboration, cohesiveness, then the scores may fall off. In addition to that, it is also important that the leader of the center can be important to note, and I think utmost important here this afternoon are these helpful hints. Number one, please make sure that you read and understand the funding announcement. Also, if there are any scientific questions, please contact the program staff and budgetary questions, contact grants management. Contacting the review office, what we will do is just forward the question to the appropriate people. In addition to that, through every process of the review, your application will be looked at for page limitations, the font size, and all the other required components. We do not want to have to return your application because you did not follow the guidelines set forth in the RFA. Also, one of the number one issues that can affect the score is grantsmanship. It is important that you're clear and concise, that you do not assume that the reviewers understand what you're talking about. It's also important, if possible, to have someone to read it to see if it's clear to them. And lastly, and important, is to start early. Applications are submitted electronically. If the deadline approaches and your application is not successfully accepted by the NIH, there is nothing we can do. So my advice is to start early. You will get a notification that it's been accepted by the funding institution. And if there are any issues with the application, it allows you time to go back and correct those and resubmit. And the last thing I want to say is that applications will be submitted in April. The review will probably not take place until the fall. So there will be an opportunity for applicants to submit supplement information. What I will do is that after the applications are received, I will send email to those particular applicants and give you the deadline and the criteria and what is allowable and not allowable after that date. And with that said, that's it for the review. I am going to send it over to Michelle Vitellino, not Lisa Edwards, who will be talking from the Grants Management Branch.
Thank you, Linda. I am Michelle Vitellino, Grants Management Specialist with the Grants Management Branch at NIEHS, colleague of Lisa Edwards. And I'm here to discuss with you the electronic submission of your budget. As you know, the electronic budget submission is submitted through the ASSIST process. We are currently using the SS-424, the Research and Related Detailed Budget Forms. We are no longer using the paper form, PHS-398. The electronic submission of the SS-424 differs slightly from the 398 in its look and feel, and as well as not having certain specific line items are not collected as they were in the PHS-398. The budget data collected on the SF-424 collects information on components and subaward levels. The component and subaward budget data is used to auto-calculate your cumulative or composite budget. When preparing your budget preparation, you may visit this link for the SF-424. We've also listed updated grants policy statements, as well as the most recent salary cap information. The IACUC approvals, your IRB approvals, you should also begin to prepare that information at the time of your application. However, a final request for that information will be requested at a later time in your just-in-time request. Under your other support, please note that effort listed under other support will need to be listed in calendar months, and the total effort should not exceed 12 calendar months. NIEHS is unable to accept effort in zero, varies, as needed, or et cetera. The P-42 should be submitted in a detailed categorical budget as opposed to a modular budget. So this is a non-modular budget submission. You should include budget submissions for each project, each core, and each subaward or consortium associated with that project or core. Please note that the SF-424 does not allow submission of subawards on subawards. Escalation can be requested. However, please note that NIH currently does not provide for escalation in out years. We recognize that institutions may have a desire to document your actual needs for budgeting and accounting purposes. However, we currently eliminate the escalation in the out years at this time. When submitting for your travel your budget travel requests for the annual meeting, please include those in the administrative core budget. Funds can be requested for travel for appropriate staff, for the director, project core leaders, business manager, and four trainees to attend the Superfund annual meeting. In your parent grant direct cost budget, consideration of equipment and out years will be based upon justification. Please note that although escalation is not provided for at this time, requests associated with special needs, equipment, increased effort will continue to be considered. However, they should be justified in your budget justification section. The subaward consortium must follow the same guidelines as the parent grant. Budget pages are also required for the subaward consortiums and should follow the associated project or core that they are associated with. The subaward consortium direct costs are included in the parent direct costs, the parent subtotal direct costs, which may be subject to budget caps. However, the FNA of subaward consortiums are not included against that budget cap. Again, budget justification should be detailed and specific. All costs are itemized, and any changes in subsequent or out year, any changes or additions in subsequent or future out years should be justified and identified in your budget justification. And here's just a snapshot of the 424 form. The SF-424, you'll include your DUNS information in the top. Associated with that organization, with your organization, please indicate if that is associated with your project or if that is to be associated with your subaward consortium. The top section of that, the top section of that form will include your personnel, your senior key personnel, and the lower half of that section will include your other personnel. Please note that the previous form, that information collects your aggregate information. Any additional information should be included in your detailed justification. Also note, under your other personnel section, please include the number of personnel that you are requesting. Specific names are not required. You can include this information in your budget justification if desired. Okay, and the next form page on the SF-424 is section C, D, and E, and this includes your section C through E. Requests for equipment should be listed here. You should include your equipment and the funds requested in the funds requested section to the right. Item D on that, the section C through E form, budget section, you will include your travel request. And please note that this continues to be treated as a single cost, regardless of the type of travel, whether it be domestic or foreign. Under section item E, you will include your participant trainee support cost request.
The next slide includes a snapshot of the SF-424 sections F through K, where your requested list for itemized costs are included here. Materials and supplies, publication cost requests, subaward consortium costs, equipment, etc. Please manually input the subaward consortium contractual costs are not pre-populated. Include both the total direct cost and indirect cost in this section. And that would be F, line item 5. The tuition request is included in item F, other direct costs. Supplies are not a major line item on the 424 budget. Please include this in line F, and that would be line item number 1. Under materials and supplies, alterations and renovations, they're not also not a major line item on the 424 budget. You include this in line item F, and that would be line item 7, under alterations and renovations. And the 424 does not include, as a major line item, inpatient and outpatient costs, which under this next slide, you'll have a snapshot of the 424 cumulative budget, and this is automatically calculated based on the budget period data that you have provided. And the final slide just gives you information on your subaward budgets. If they are less than, if you're requesting less than 30 subaward, the assist system will automatically include those with the application. So there's no need to attach them as separate files. If you are requesting over 30, then you will need to include that as separate files. And that concludes our budget section for the electronic budget preparation. And I'll turn it over to Danielle.
Oh, thanks, Michelle.
So I'm Danielle Carlin, and I'm a program administrator with the Superfund Research Program. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the SRP P42 application process and how it's moving to electronic submission. So we're going to be using an application called Assist, and what we've been told is it's a vast improvement over our paper process. However, I'm only going to talk about the basics of Assist and how it applies to the SRP's current P42 RFA. I would highly, highly recommend that you visit the resources that are listed at the end of my portion for more information. Also, as a note, I'm borrowing slides from the publicly available NIH tutorial on how to use Assist. So I apologize if you find that some of the slides are slightly out of the order of the tutorial. Okay, so what is Assist? It stands for the Application Submission System and Interface for Submission Tracking. It's used for the preparation and submission of multi-project applications only. And what it does for multi-project applications is basically the same things that grants.gov downloadable forms does for single project applications. Okay, so some of the key features of Assist include that it can leverage existing ERA Commons credentials that many of you already have. It pre-populates data from the ERA Commons profiles. You'll be able to control application access. It'll validate grants.gov and NIH business rules before you submit. And it provides a preview of the application image. And this is the image that you'll be using for, that will be used for the review process. And there will also be automatic generation of headers and footers, and it will provide the ability to track the status of the grant within the system itself. Okay, so as you can tell from our RFA, we are one of the participating funding opportunity announcements that clearly states that we require electronic submission. So you'll be able to find the apply for grant electronically. It's right under the key date section at the beginning of this funding opportunity announcement. Okay, and this next slide. So when you read the RFA, you'll be able to see that we have information about application and submission in Section 4, and that's going to be critical to helping you prepare your application in Assist. There's also a link to the SF-424 application guide, which provides general instructions for completing the application forms. And when the instructions in the application guide conflict with the instructions in our RFA will win. So just another note, the SF-424 R&R instructions are not going to get updated specifically for ASSIST as of right now, but there is the possibility that NIH could be working on that. Okay, so in this slide, I'm still in the RFA text that's in Section 4, and each of the multi-project application announcements will have a table that will include the page limits, and that will list the types of components that are going to be allowed for an FOA and the components that will be presented to you in ASSIST. So the overall component is the overview of the entire application. ASSIST is going to enforce that a 12-page research strategy can be submitted, and then following that general table will be additional component-specific instructions. Okay, so you'll notice in every multi-project and core funding opportunity announcement, there's also going to be a table that compares the overall component with all the other components, and it will guide you with what types of forms need to be filled out in order to complete those components. Okay, so this is the really important part. So following that general table in the previous slide, this is where you're going to find additional component-specific instructions that are very specific to the P42 funding announcement. It's really important that you read these because this will guide you in preparing the specific P42 application. Okay, so now let's take a little look at ASSIST. So once you click on the Apply for Grant Electronically, you'll see the ASSIST login page. All ASSIST users must have an ERA Commons credential with one of the following roles. They could be a signing official, an administrative official, principal investigator, or somebody with an account administrator role. So if you're going to be the person who submits the application, you'll also need an active grants.gov authorized organization representative or an AOR account. So not everybody in your organization can initiate an application. If you'd like more information on who can initiate the application, please refer to the resources at the end of my section. So to access the ASSIST system, you're going to use your ERA Commons credentials, and you're going to hit that the login button to get into the system. So by the way, you can also use the URL that's listed above in this slide to access the system. Okay, so once you're logged in, the first screen that you'll come to will be where you're able to either initiate an application or search for in-progress applications. You can type in the RFA number, and in our case, that's going to be the ES13001, and then you'll hit the Go button. Okay, so this is the first screen that you'll come to, and this is where to the Initiate Application screen. And this is basically that header information that's posted in grants.gov and basically tells grants.gov how to route that application once it receives your application. Okay, so then at the bottom of that same screen, this is where you would provide the minimal information that you need to save the application. So you can see that you have to give it a center title, although it will be called an application project title. Since you've used your Commons account credentials, you can choose from a drop-down list of the organizations that are associated with your Commons account to populate the remaining information. Okay, so once you've initiated the application, you'll begin to enter information about the overview of the entire application. So this will include information such as application type, whether it's a new, a revised application, resubmission, renewal, your start and end date of the entire application, who the principal investigator, which in this case would be the center director, will be of the application, your center title for the entire application, and it's got the lead organization information there that was already pulled from the Commons ID. So you're going to click Save, and at that point your overall component has been added to your application. Okay. So ASSIST will then take you to the forms that you're supposed to fill out for the overall component. I just want to mention as a side note that you will see a very similar format for each of the components. And when I say components, I'm talking about the projects and cores. But it's nice to know that ASSIST will pull the correct format and put the forms across the top in tabs depending on which component that you're working on. So to fill out the overall component, you just go tab by tab, and you can see them above, and fill out your application data. It would also benefit you to read the SF4 424 guidelines simultaneously to be sure that you enter the correct information into each of the tabs. I'm going to try to walk you through each of the tabs with the overall component, though you'll see very similar, but you'll see some slides that contain other components. Essentially, the tabs are very similar between the components. Okay, so now I'll try to take you through each of the tabs. Remember that each component, again, projects and cores, that's very similar. So I'll just take you through the overall component for now. Every component has a summary component page, which you can see highlighted here in blue. This has the component information and the application information towards the bottom, which was a little cut here from this particular slide. It tells you who the project leads are designated, who the organization is, and the status of the application. And in most cases, when you get to this step, you would have a work in progress status. And as you can see in this, it says final in this particular slide. But again, this was an example from NIH. Okay, so the next tab is the R&R cover, highlighted in blue, and I would suggest that you follow the SF424 guidelines to fill out this section. I've included a little bit of information on the next slide about what types of things should go into this area. One feature you might not quite understand is the edit and get lock button. This is actually a label that's had a little bit of controversy up at NIH and with other potential users, and eventually they're going to change it to the word edit, but what it means is once you physically hit that edit button, you'll be the only one that can then edit that form. Other people can view it, but you are the only person that could edit. Another thing to remember is that you don't have the ability to lock a component. You can only lock a form within a component. So once you get done with your data entry, then you're going to save and release lock. So these are the kinds of information that will go into the R&R cover form. It includes the general cover sheet info, and you can read these here. You can see also from this table that you need to fill out all the form fields for the overall component, but the projects and cores, then you'd have to fill out these particular fields that are shown on the right hand of the table. I just want to remind you to be descriptive in your title. So, for example, don't just say Project 1 for your first project. It's best to give it a title that will signify the project. Okay, so before I move on to the other project information tab, please refer to the SF424 for instructions on filling out the cover page component and the cover page supplement tabs. I didn't have a screenshot for the other project information, so I've just circled the tab. So you can see up above where it says other project information. This is where you'll fill out such things as partnerships with international collaborators. It's also where you'll enter your center summary or abstract. And that, of course, will be a summary that's going to be distributed to the public domain. And it should give an overall indication of the scientific problem or hypotheses that your center is proposing and how it plans to address that problem. And it should not be used for the research plan. Item 8 is for the project narrative, and this is where you'll include the public health relevance statement. And in item 10, that's the facilities and other resources, and that's where you'll provide the description of the scientific environment to where the research will be done. And then in item 12, you can see circled here, this is particularly important to the P42 application. This is where you're going to include such things as the center organizational structure, which is going to be the diagram of your organizational structure of your center, the table of research support core utilization, table of all professional and non-professional personnel, table of changes to projects and cores, table of research approaches for the use of human subjects, vertebrate animals, international collaborations, and stem cells. But before I move on, I just want to mention that when you're looking at the RFA, please note that the other project information table will be where you should load the file title Relation to Overall Center under the other attachments. So please read the RFA for more detailed description of what should be included in the relation to the overall center. So that's very important. Okay, so now that we've been talking about the overall component, okay, so I just want to mention, so I know I've been talking about the overall component, yet this slide talks about the admin core. Again, I'm just borrowing slides from the NIH tutorial, but the CITAB is very similar between the components. So in the case of the overall component, you'll add the primary performance site, but within each project and core, you would add the sites of where the research or activities would be taking place, depending on the project or core. Okay, again, this is a slide that says core and not overall component, but again, they're essentially the same. In the case of the overall component, you will add the center director in this section, as well as any other key personnel. In the case of the project or core, this is where you'll add the project or core leaders as well as any other personnel associated with that project or core. So when you are in the senior key person form, you have two options to do pre-population. You can actually choose from a list of people that have already been used within your application. You can use them on the second, third, fourth component that you you can actually just choose from them from a drop-down list. And the information from them will be pre-populated for you, or you can put their common IDs, and the grants.gov will pull the commons profile. So you'll have two options really for pre-population there. The other one is to actually enter all the data in from hand, but if you can use it automatically, that'd be even better. There's also one more thing that I wanted to mention, that if you have a project or core leader that is on more than one component, only one biosketch will be allowed for that person that covers the entire application. So, you know, again, realize that there's only one biosketch per application for each person that's a part of the application. So I'm not going to talk about the R&R budget tab because our grants management specialist, Michelle Victolino, has already discussed that. So I'm going to move on to the research plan tab. Most information that's requested in here is specific to this funding opportunity announcement, and it should be included as a part of the research strategy section. I wanted to call to your attention about not getting confused with the research plan tab and the research strategy tab. So, and also for you to remember that the research strategy is limited to 12 pages, regardless if we're talking about the overall component or any of the other components, being the projects and cores. So the research plan is where you'd include your introduction, specific aims, research strategy, et cetera. Okay, so very briefly, I'm going to go over adding additional components. So as you can probably tell for this FOA, there are a number of components that are required. And just to reiterate what Dr. Heather Henry said earlier, required cores are the administrative core, the research translation, community engagement and training, and optional are the research support cores. So in this example, the administrative core was selected. So please note that you'll be presented with the minimal information that's needed to save that component, which is really the start and end dates and the core and project title. The start date is pre-populated from what was given on the overall component, but it is editable. And the component end date is manually entered at this point. So you'll fill in that date and then hit save. And then your admin core has been added to the navigation down on the lower left-hand corner. And then also remember to click Save. Okay, so as you can see, the admin core has been added to the navigation down on the lower left-hand corner. And it's basically the same thing that you're going to do throughout all the different components that we laid out in our funding opportunity announcement. So also as a reminder, in the case of the admin core, the tabs have been defined by ASSIST for use with the admin core, and they'll be defined depending on which component that you're working on. Okay, almost finished. So then as you should go on and continue to add your components, the projects, and cores, it's also important to note that the additional cores will be presented in alphabetical order, so this is also very important for you to know. And it's also, and also note that the cores are going to show before all of the projects. So projects are going to be presented in the order that they were prepared in Assist. So it's important for you to enter Project 1 before entering Project 2, and so on. I also want to emphasize that it's critical that you set up the application shell first before entering additional data to the various fields, because once you have that set up, you won't be able to rearrange the components. And NIH is working on another version of Assist, and then potentially in the future, we'd be able to do some rearrangement. So I would suggest that you have one person do the initial setup, and then the other investigators could access their portion of the application after all has been set up. So in other words, you may not want to have all the projects and core leaders going in simultaneously and adding their information haphazardly. And you know, again, just to reiterate, you might want to have a game plan when you're entering in information. So I think it's important to mention to give yourself, as Dr. Linda Bass said here, give yourself and your project and core leaders plenty of time to familiarize yourselves with Assist so that you have a final product that you're proud to submit to us and to NIH. Just a few other comments. Also, each project is going to be assigned a system-generated random three-digit number. NIH has made them sequential at this point because in the future there'll be the ability to abandon a component, to reshuffle the order in which they're placed in the application. However, each project will be numbered sequentially in which, when you preview the application that was submitted to NIH. And again, more information on the tutorials will be given for that. Okay, just a few more things. The project accords within the P42 application. There's some additional information. For the projects, you'll want to include a relation to the overall center in the other attachment section under the other projects information tab. For all the cores, you'll want to include a relation to overall center in the other attachment section. For the training core, you'll need a diversity recruitment and retention plan. And if you're a renewal application, then you'll want to include a trainee list in the other attachment section. And for the admin core, the research and related senior key person profile, that would be the center director. And finally, for the community engagement core, the community engagement statement will be included in the research strategy section under the research plan tab. So, okay, so once again, I'm going to highly recommend that you preview all the resources that I have listed here because they'll have a lot more information, probably better than what I did today. So, for example, on managing access to the application, previewing your application, getting assistance for Assist, preparing the final submission of the application, and tracking submission status. So I'd like to just thank you for your attention, and we wish you success in using this new system. And if you have any questions, Heather and I are also available to try to help you navigate through the system. So, and let me just close out. Here's our contact information, so feel free to contact us if you have any questions. And I am going to turn it over now to Jean Belent, our host, for any instructions on how to ask questions from our audience.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. We're going to go ahead and start with the question and answer portion for today's session. Many of you may have already submitted questions electronically using the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. And in fact, a number of the questions have actually been addressed, but we're going to go ahead and read some of those out loud and just get a verbal confirmation of the answer as well. If you haven't yet entered your question or are in the process of doing so, you can still continue to submit them in that lower right corner of your screen. We're going to go through the online questions first, and then with the time that we have remaining, we'll invite those of you who are on the phone lines to unmute if you'd like to ask a question out loud on the phones. So again, we're going to start with the online ones, and then we'll move on to the ones on the phone. So the first question, we've again, addressed some, but the very first question asked, how much detail is allowed for the appendix? Is there a page limit?
The question, can we repeat the question, please?
Sure. The question asks, how much detail is allowed for the appendix? Is there a page limit?
While there's not a page limit for the appendix material, you should be reminded that the application should be able to stand alone. The appendix material is just supportive of the application. And you should not put anything in the appendix material that's required for the application that may affect the evaluation and the scoring of the application. And as a reminder, the review committee will get both the application, the appendix material, supplemental data, and the other review-related information, but reviewers do not always look at the appendix material.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question is just asking if they can confirm that this RFA is to be submitted through grants.gov and not by paper.
Yes, so the question, I'm just going to repeat it for the group here, that you were asking whether or not the application is submitted through grants.gov. Really, the answer is to use the assist system, and I provided the URL there, but also if you access our current RFA, you can hit the button that says submit grant electronically. So that's the best way to do it.
Okay, great. The next question, can the LOI include suggested reviewers for specific projects and cores?
This is Linda Bass. Please do not submit suggested reviewers to us. The LOI should be restricted only to the information pertinent to the particular application, like the research projects and cores, the names of the institutions, and the names of the key personnel in the application.
Okay, great. Our next question is asking, is community engagement, that component, one-page statement, part of the 12-page limit for your community engagement core?
Yes. So this is Danielle, and Heather's in the room, too, but that's a part of the research strategy section. That's where it should be included.
Okay, great. We have another question that asks, is the AIMS page part of the 12-page limit for community engagement core?
This is Heather Henry, and there's been a lot of discussion about that question in the room. I believe that ASSIST has a separate specific AIMS attachment for within each core, so that each core can upload its aims, and so then there'd be another separate attachment for the research strategy. So that means that no, the specific aims would not be a part of that 12-page limit of the research strategy. If, as long as ASSIST gives you that option to upload the specific aims separately, then that's certainly how it's supposed to be done. We actually don't have access to what ASSIST looks like. And so that's the only caveat I'll add, is that we can't ground truth this for you guys. Maybe one of y'all can help us offline, because you do have access to what the components can be loaded. But as far as we know, the aims are attached separately than the research strategy section for cores. And again, there's some disagreement in the room. So we'll post final answers on a Q&A on our website, just to resolve that one.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question actually asks if you can elaborate a bit more on what type of supplemental information submitted after April 10th is allowable.
Okay, I had wanted to email these to the applicants in particular, but I'll just mention it here. You're probably allowed 3 pages total, and allowable information will be updated publications, updated grant support, and any change in major key personnel.
Okay, great. Thank you. So our next question, this is a little bit of a long one, so I'm going to read this out loud. And they ask, will the RTC and CEC portions of the proposal be separately reviewed? Our and some other RTCs and CECs have included the elements described on the comparison slide, but again divided them slightly differently between the cores. If the RTC and CEC portions are to be separately reviewed, there might be some aspects missed because they are covered in that other core. So again, they just want to double-check, will these sections be considered together at any point in the process prior to the whole center evaluation?
Based on past reviews, they have been reviewed separately.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have one user who would like to know which section does the budget justification belong in. Usually a leadership plan and implementation plan is part of the budget justification for a core.
This is Lisa Edwards. The budget justification comes directly after whatever project or core, after your budget section. I'm not exactly sure what you are asking when you say leadership plan and implementation plan, because that's not a part of the budget section.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have another question related to budget, and that one is asking, does that mean that travel to the annual meeting needs to be included for all project and core leaders in the admin core budget?
This is Lisa Edwards again. We would like to see the admin, the director, research translation, everybody except for the project leaders and the core leaders should come out of the administrative core. The other travelees or project leaders can come out of the specific project or core.
And they wouldn't even, I mean, this could be general travel out of a project in core. It wouldn't need to be specifically for the annual meeting if it appears in their budget. But we do want to see in the admin core an allowance for four trainees to travel, the director, the core, the research translation core leaders, the training core leaders. We just want to make sure that it's clear that those people are going to be covered and will be at the meeting each year.
Wonderful. Thank you. Our next question asks if funding for instrumentation maintenance contracts can be included in the budget.
Yes, that can be included in the budget request.
Okay, great. We have another question asking if letters of support are included in one section or are they separately included for each project and core?
This is Linda Bass. Please include them separately for each project and core.
And they would go in the other attachment section.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. We have another user who is asking if a PMD has not yet been assigned, how do we cite those publications?
So the PMCID, it's fine. There should usually be a temporary number, which is called the NIHSD, there's another temporary number that's given, I think, for the first, like, 3 months before it's assigned a PMCID. But if it hasn't, you could say it's either in progress or if it's just been submitted, you can say submitted or in press or something. But anyway, there should be probably an easier way to follow publications now that this is being followed electronically. But I think at this point, that's all the information we would need.
Okay, great. We do have another question that just came in asking how you would evaluate or view a research project that focused on a better characterization of a Superfund site, the routes of exposure, and or the health outcomes. And I don't know if you can comment on that or if that's kind of beyond the scope of what you're chatting about today.
My suggestion would be that individual give us a call and send us some more specific information as to what is being proposed. We could probably spend the next 2 hours having that discussion right here, and I think it'd be more appropriate to do it one-on-one.
Okay, great. We had another user who specifically asked if they should use a PHS 398 continuation page for the research plan.
So this is Danielle. I think there was a similar question that was asked earlier on just online. Really, it's best to follow the SF-424 guidelines because that will tell you the exact forms that you need to use. There is discussion of the PHS 398 form, but it's used for the various just the development of the application. So again, rely on the SF-424 guidelines for information on that.
Okay, great. Thank you. So let's go ahead and turn to those who might be on the telephone lines. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute and ask a question out loud. So again, we've globally muted the lines. Anybody on the phones who wants to ask a question out loud will need to hit *7 to unmute their phone. And feel free to identify their organization and to ask their question. While we're waiting to see if we have anybody on the phone lines, again, you can still have a minute or so to try to type up any other electronic questions if we haven't yet addressed them. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, we are just right past our scheduled end time of 3 p.m. Eastern. I don't see any additional questions in our online queue, and I also don't hear anybody on the phone lines. So I'll go ahead and leave it to Heather and Danielle and Michelle and the other speakers from the Superfund Research Program to make any closing statements or comments before we begin the formal closeout for today's seminar.
Well, I want to thank you all for participating in this webinar. I want to thank the people around the table for answering your questions. As I mentioned in my remarks and as other people mentioned, if you have any very specific questions with regards to either the science or the processes, please let us know. Please keep us informed about what you're going to do. As was mentioned earlier, the letter of intent is not required, but it really is helpful in so many ways. And again, thank you all, and have a good afternoon. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you so very much. With that, I'm going to go ahead and formally close out today's seminar. Just a brief reminder, again, through the Cleanup Information Network, we do offer a variety of resources on characterizing and cleaning hazardous waste sites in the U.S. If you're interested in kind of staying in touch with us and learning more about our free training opportunities or the resources we provide, I'd encourage you to visit us at cluin.org, or feel free to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. The other items to kind of point out, we do have a number of resources that were made available for today's seminar. You were able to access these related websites on the related URLs window that you see live on the right side of your screen today. All of those websites and URLs are actually available on the seminar homepage, including a copy of the presentation material that was presented today. So I would encourage you to browse back to the seminar homepage and actually click the button that says resources or links, and you'll be able to download the slides and, again, access all of the URLs that are hyperlinked there. And that website will be up from this point forward, so you can refer back to it at any time. We would ask if you could take just a minute to fill out the short feedback form for today's session. That's also available in the related URLs page and also on the seminar homepage. It just asks for a couple of basic pieces of information about how you participated today, what you thought of the topic, how it was delivered, and we do read each and every one of the submissions. So we do thank those of you in advance. You can fill that form out. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today, for example, for CEUs or PDHs, we don't necessarily offer certificates on CLUIN. However, if you fill out the feedback form, you can check a box and have a confirmation email sent to your own records just to at least verify that you participated and submitted feedback after the live delivery. If you shared the line with multiple parties today, you can each take a turn filling out your own feedback form and getting your own confirmation message. And you may find that, in addition to a copy of the presentation materials and or your registration email, may be enough to earn you credit with your accrediting institution. Again, today's session was recorded, and you will automatically get an email with the URL to play back the seminar as soon as it's available. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to provide those. I want to thank everyone who was able to join us today, in particular our organizers who joined us from the Superfund Research Program. And again, we had nearly 80 people who joined us from all over the country today, so I want to thank those of you who took time out of your busy days to join us. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we will either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN seminar. This will be the formal conclusion for